Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program, Experts Discuss Port Quartz. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note that this call may be recorded. I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Kate Boyd. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Nikki, and thank you to everyone on the call for joining us today. Earlier this year, the Department of Homeland Security announced the Migration Protection Protocols, MPP for short, which requires individuals seeking asylum at our southern border to remain in Mexico while their U.S. removal proceedings are pending. Since the implementation of the program, more than 42,000 vulnerable asylum seekers have been forced to wait in Mexico until their court date comes up. From the beginning, MPP has been a deeply problematic program and one that AILA has followed very closely. It erects insurmountable hurdles to representation to begin with. In a letter to acting DHS Secretary McAleenan, AILA asylum experts stated that legal services providers that are able to represent individuals subject to MPP are scarce, and when they are available, they face significant obstacles when trying to communicate with their clients in advance of a hearing. Additionally, the well-documented violence and instability that migrants face in Mexico exposes these returned asylum seekers to severe risk of further trauma while they wait for their hearings. However, instead of ending MPP, given those serious due process concerns, DHS had made plans to expand it, even pulling $155 million from FEMA's Disaster Relief Fund to build temporary courts along the southern border. In July, MPP was expanded to include Laredo and Brownsville, where DHS has built massive temporary temp facilities that are functioning as virtual courtrooms for MPP cases. Media reports have revealed that the administration anticipates conducting approximately 420 virtual hearings a day in Laredo and 720 virtual hearings a day in Brownsville. So these are going to be high-volume facilities we're talking about. The rollout of these port courts has been shrouded in secrecy. DHS did not provide advance public information to attorneys or other stakeholders about even the most basic operational logistics related to the new tent courts, despite their apparent launch this week. Hearings in Laredo started yesterday, and hearings in Brownsville start today, a fact which, again, was not publicly communicated in advance. Today, I'm joined by several experts in the field who will share the latest intel on these problematic port courts, as well as their insights on the due process concerns that the video-only courts raise. Denise Gilman is on the call. She is director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Texas, Austin. Ashley Huebner is the associate director of legal services at the National Immigrant Justice Center. And Jody Goodwin is an immigration attorney in Harlingen, Texas, who works directly with people subject to MPP, both in the U.S. and in Mexico. Denise, do you want to start us off?
Yes, thank you so much, and thanks to all who are on the call. I really just want to start by framing this and making very clear that the MPP or Remain in Mexico process and the courts that have been set up in tents down in South Texas really provide just a facade of a process. This is not about adjudicating cases and deciding who should be allowed to remain or to come into the United States and who should be turned away. It really is just a system that has been set up in its entire structure to turn people away. There is a complete lack of respect for fundamental due process provisions, standards in the proceedings. The courts down in South Texas expand dramatically the use of the deeply problematic video hearings that have been taking place in detention centers around the country, but now will be taking place on a massive scale without even any guarantees that the equipment will function properly and with serious impacts on the asylum seekers in these hearings. Imagine trying to tell a court by video with a judge you can barely see about torture that you've experienced, and after managing enough courage to tell the story of what you've experienced, video cutting out and you losing all contact with the court. That's the kind of scenario that we'll see here. There are, of course, very serious access to counsel problems, also presenting serious due process issues. Others will talk further about that. And again, As mentioned, the entire proceeding is taking place in tents and cargo containers where the public cannot go. This just goes completely contrary to every American sense of justice and due process. In addition, the entire program puts the U.S. in a situation of directly endangering asylum seekers by returning them to conditions in Mexico to wait for their hearings, where we know that the violence in the cities along the border in northern Mexico is extreme and is particularly targeted at people who have been returned through the MPP program because of their vulnerable status as immigrants who are known to have some connection to the U.S., even if it's just through the proceedings. I personally have spoken in the last couple of days with multiple families who have suffered kidnapping, several families being kidnapped immediately after being sent back across the bridge to Nuevo Laredo as a result of the MPP program. In essence, this program really is just part of an overall effort by this administration to end asylum protections for people arriving at our southern borders. It's a way of turning away, locking the door, closing the door on vulnerable refugees who really need our protection in the United States and who should merit it under both U.S. and international law that binds us and requires us to protect them. It's really a betrayal of U.S. values, and I'll start there, and I'll be happy to answer questions as we move forward. And I'd like to turn it over to Ashley now.
Thanks, Denise. You know, I would echo everything that Kate and Denise just said. I think it's really important to keep in mind that the due process violations that are inherent in the Remain in Mexico policy don't just start at the courts themselves, especially for the quote-unquote port courts in Laredo and Brownsville. As Kate and Denise noted, individuals who are subject to Remain in Mexico in Laredo, as in Brownsville, are in particularly dangerous situations. I think everyone who is subject to Remain in Mexico is facing similar security risks, but particularly across from Laredo and across from Brownsville, individuals are being forced to remain in a part of Mexico that has a level 4 do not travel warning from the Department of State. Like Denise, nearly everyone I have spoken with when I was in Laredo had experienced some kind of threat or attack from a cartel, including kidnappings, being shot at, being extorted. People reported that shelters are becoming adverse to hosting migrants because there is substantial pressure from the cartels. Individuals are also dealing with serious health issues during this time as well. And these safety concerns really impact all aspects of the process, including the ability of these individuals to communicate with potential counsel and the ability to even get to court for their hearings. I heard from many people who were terrified about having to travel at night or in the early morning, some from several hours away and with small children, to get to the bridge by 4 or 4:30 in the morning for court, as they were instructed to do. When it comes to the court itself, I think it's a little ridiculous to call this a court. It's a tent facility. The structure has purposely been set up so that the Department of Homeland Security, rather than the Department of Justice, has complete control and authority over access and procedure. And in turn, the Department of Justice has completely abdicated all control over the facility and policies to DHS because these facilities are allegedly on CBP property. And of course, as Kate mentioned, all of this was accomplished through the millions of dollars that were taken from FEMA's disaster relief funds. There's been no transparency, as was said earlier, from DHS about anything related to the tent facilities. In Laredo itself, there are no signs or information for attorneys or others about how to enter the tent facility. At the tent facility itself, there's only one metal door on one side of the tent that has a keypad with no signs to indicate it's a court or how anybody should get in. When I was there, I asked an ICE officer how an attorney with a court hearing should get in since there was no doorbell, and the officer basically told me that attorneys should wait around until they see a security guard and essentially flag the guard down in order to get in. Inside the Laredo tent facility, when you walk in, there's a waiting area similar to other courts you'd see around the country with chairs and a metal detector. But then outside of this room leads you to a number of different modular shipping container type buildings of different sizes. The larger ones are used for master calendar status hearings, and then there are smaller shipping containers that are being used for attorney-client meetings and for non-refoulement interviews. I was told that some of the smaller ones would also be used for merits hearings, but I did not specifically see those. Yesterday was the first day of hearings in Laredo, and the tent facility was absolutely full of ICE officers and contract security officers. I did not see anyone there who was identified to me as being connected with the Department of Justice or the Executive Office for Immigration Review, other than the judge that I was able to see on a TV screen through a window into the shipping container hearing room. I was told that asylum seekers, which yesterday included men, women, and children, were brought in around 6 in the morning, and then court began right at 8:30. I was told that if attorneys wanted to meet with their clients before court, they could do so, but that the use of the shipping container meeting spaces would be dependent on how many attorneys wanted to meet with clients and also whether they needed to be used by asylum officers for non-refoulement interviews. And I was told that per the asylum office, even though the non-refoulement interviews would be occurring in the same shipping containers as the attorney-client meetings, attorneys would not be allowed to be present during the client's non-refoulement interviews, which is really problematic given the reports we've heard from asylum officers themselves that the non-refoulement interviews are a completely results-driven process. Before I was kicked out of the facility, I ran into an attorney who had a client who appeared in court yesterday, and I was able to briefly debrief with her. She reported that nobody was prepared for anyone there to be represented, and despite having provided her information and her appearance form to security, the judge didn't know she was there, and when her client was called, she effectively had to jump up and wave her arms at the video screen to let the judge know she was there to represent the respondent. She was not allowed to bring her assistant into court with her, and this raises a lot of concerns. Concerns for attorneys who do not speak the same language as their clients. We heard this morning that in court, interpreters were not being allowed to be brought in with attorneys into court itself, which is a huge problem. My organization works with large numbers of volunteer pro bono attorneys, and interpreters are critical to their work. And if they are not able to bring an interpreter with them to have side conversations with their clients in court, it raises huge due process concerns. So I just want to end by noting that, I think immigrants and advocates have faced similar due process and transparency issues for years with immigration courts that are located inside of DHS detention facilities. But now with the Remain in Mexico policy, the administration has restructured the asylum system so that everyone who is coming to the southern border seeking safety is being forced to do so in the same due process black hole. And I will now turn things over to Jody.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you. So I want to echo everything that Ashley and Kate and Denise have talked about with respect to the due process issues. But what I want to focus on for a bit, if I may, is the incredible lack of transparency on the part of the government with respect to this new process for hearing removal proceedings. For now, over 6 weeks, I've been making efforts to dialogue with both the Department of Justice and with the Department of Homeland Security with respect to what would be, essentially logistical concerns about when and where and how people should present themselves in Matamoros at the port of entry to go to court, but also to be able to provide information that is particularly relevant and important for attorneys that will be representing people in MPP courts. I was not given any information at all, and in fact, I never received a response, neither from DOJ or from DHS until yesterday afternoon when I received a non-responsive email indicating to me that they had no information to give me and that if they did have information in the future, they would reach out. To that end, what happens is this. It's an incredible due process concern, especially in the Brownsville-Matamoros court. As Ashley has mentioned, the area in which the migrants are forced to remain in Tamaulipas, Mexico, is a level 4 security threat assessment by the Department of State. In addition, there's it's widely held knowledge that you're not to run around in those cities in the middle of the night. It's problematic for migrants, especially because they are in particularly targeted by organized crime for kidnapping, ransom, for extortion, and other forms of assaultive behavior, to be having to appear at court, at 4 o'clock in the morning, which is what the instructions have given to them. The other problem, and Ashley didn't mention this, is the fact that it's a very dangerous place for people to go in and of itself. In Laredo, there aren't any organizations or attorneys that are actively going into Laredo precisely because of the security threat. In Matamoros, we've been able to develop a process where we can have makeshift legal workshops and legal orientations right at the foot of the bridge in the refugee encampment and be relatively safe in terms of being 20 to 50 feet from the turnstile to come back to the United States. But even at that, there are very, very few attorneys that are willing to avail themselves of that type of threat assessment. And it shouldn't happen that way. The fact that individuals have the right to counsel with MPP, the effective access to counsel has been completely broken. There's an abysmal rate of representation among MPP cases throughout the Southwest border, and my fear, at least in the Laredo courts as well as the Brownsville courts, is that that abysmal 1% rate is going to drop even below 1%. Simply because of the security threat assessment for the Tamaulipas area. What that means for clients is this. Those individuals that have decided to wait for their hearings, to stick it out, to deal with the threat concerns to themselves and their families while they're waiting in Mexico for these hearings, have an incredible lack of access to legal information. They don't have access to law libraries. They don't have access to readily available information about even such basic things as how to fill out a 589, or for that matter, how to even get a 589, which is the asylum application itself, much less gathering evidence, providing translations, being able to submit those documents in the form that's required by the court. And what it means is that you have a number of individuals, hundreds of individuals, waiting on the Mexican side, desperate for legal information, and desperate for any way to be able to help themselves to be able to get out of the situation that they're in, most of whom want to be able to present their case to the court, want to be able to share with the court what their fears are of returning to their home countries. However, they just don't have the means to be able to do that. So to that end, we do have a project in Matamoros that we provide legal orientation as well as workshops so that hopefully we can reach as many people as possible to have them be prepared for their court. I can tell you that this morning, that was not the case. The individuals that were scheduled for court this morning, which was the launch of the first hearings in Brownsville, were all unrepresented and were very confused, very uninformed. And that confusion and misinformation was also carried through with the court, with the trial attorneys, with the staff, in terms of not being able to provide readily available information to individuals about how they could follow through with their asylum applications. I will be around also for questions, and I think at this point we are going to turn it over and open to questions.
Thanks so much, Jody. It's shocking to me that our government can roll out this kind of policy with such widespread serious consequences without communicating even those most basic details that affect people. So thanks to you and thanks to all of our speakers for all the hard work that you all are doing to sort of force transparency and ensure that migrants subject to MPP know their basic rights when possible. With that, I think we can go ahead and open it up to questions. I will flag that Jody has to hop off the call at 1:15 Eastern time.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1. Now we will take our first question from Molly Hennessy Fisk.
Hi, thanks for doing the call, everyone. Do we know how many cases total have been heard at these courts so far, and have they said anything about allowing more access? They said a little bit on the DHS call yesterday, and I wondered if that had been communicated to you all at all.
Go ahead.
Molly, this is Jody. I can tell you that at the Brownsville court, they have 6 master calendar courtrooms that can house about 48 people in each courtroom. It's not clear as to whether or not they'll be running all six master calendar courtrooms at any given time. In addition to those master calendar courtrooms, they have 60 individual courtrooms, so for individuals that are already at a merits phase of their case. This morning there were only six people on the docket. It was the first day of the launch. And other than that, I don't have any statistics on the total number of people that will be heard.
Denise Gilman here. I just want to make very clear that almost all of the asylum seekers in these proceedings will have 3 or 4 hearings. So it's multiple times that they're going to have to come to the bridge at 4:30 in the morning in dangerous conditions, because there are initial hearings and then merits hearings. And another thing that's really important to understand about the final merits hearing is that in the best scenario with an in-person hearing in court, these are very intensive, difficult hearings where asylum seekers must tell the details of the most traumatic events of their life, and it's an extremely trying process that's going to be aggravated only significantly more by the fact that this is taking place by video from within tents after people have been living in very precarious situations subject to additional violence. And typically in those hearings, those final hearings, it's well established that those who are represented by counsel are much more likely to win, about 6 times more likely to win those final merits hearings. And so counsel is so important, as Jody has mentioned, and yet so limited. One more point I'd like to make about counsel that I think is critical is that in an asylum case, it is almost impossible to present an asylum case effectively without meeting with your client, not once, but multiple times for hours and hours and hours because of the detail that's required by law and because of the trauma that makes it difficult for people to tell their stories. So the fact that the client lawyers are in Mexico, where the lawyers cannot easily go and in some cases cannot go at all without experiencing extreme danger themselves, really makes this situation completely untenable in terms of presenting an asylum claim.
This is Ashley. I would just add on to that particular piece that I think one thing that's also incredibly problematic about the setup is the ability for attorneys to even understand a full individual's claim from the very get-go, to fully understand why they are seeking asylum and get all the information, is completely compromised by the fact that you're talking to somebody in Mexico who's not able to speak with you in a confidential space and is maybe extremely reluctant to reveal very sensitive information when a child is nearby, when complete strangers are nearby in a shelter, when individuals who pose a threat to their lives are nearby. And so the ability to even get enough information to advise somebody on the strengths of their claim is completely compromised by this process. But to the original question about the hearings and the numbers, I was told that in Laredo this week, each day there would be no more than 20 hearings or 20 people. I'm not clear because some are family units, and that they would slowly be escalating them up to getting to around the 400 in a couple weeks.
And I'll just say, this is Kate, you know, we have not heard more from DHS on access for legal orientation programs or pro bono attorneys who want to go in and do screenings or anything like that. I did hear that DHS mentioned it on a call yesterday, but they have not reached out to advocates that I'm aware of. I think obviously we feel strongly that that's something that needed to happen before these courts were made live, not as an afterthought once they start hearing from advocates about it.
And we will take our next question from Sylvia Foster Frau of San Antonio Express. Your line is open.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for doing this. So I just wanted to ask a little bit more about the non-refoulement interviews. I sat in on MPP hearings from here in San Antonio, and two of the families were kind of begging the judge to not have to stay in Mexico, and he directed them to those interviews. So I guess I'm wondering, what would make them eligible for this kind of relief, and like, what are the chances of them being able to basically get out of staying in Mexico through these interviews?
This is Jody. I'll address the non-refoulement interviews. In theory, in individuals that are afraid of returning to Mexico to remain in Mexico while they wait for their hearings can approach CBP at any time to request a non-refoulement interview. Practically speaking, in Matamoros, what that means is you have to pay a quarter to pass through the turnstile go to the middle of the bridge where the CBP metering officers are, explain to them that you want a non-refoulement interview. You're going to be met with varying levels of knowledge about that non-refoulement interview. So the majority of people that have tried that have just been turned around at the top of the bridge and not actually given an interview. Now, some people, through insistence or because they had counsel with them at the time that they asked for the non-refoulement interview, insisting upon speaking with supervisors and such, they can get that interview. Now, in other courts, the non-refoulement interview is something that is sort of built into some of the judges' dialogue with the respondents as they're sitting in court, and they regularly ask people if they are afraid of returning to Mexico to raise their hand so that they can be held over for a non-refoulement interview. I would note that in court today in Harlingen, the immigration judge did not ask anyone if they were afraid of returning to Mexico. So no indication whatsoever that they could request a non-refoulement interview was made. To the issue of what happens at those interviews, that is also shrouded in secrecy because attorneys are not allowed to represent their clients or to attend or listen in to those interviews. And the actual approval rate of individuals being granted a non-refoulement and taken out of the MPP program is incredibly scarce. I mean, in terms of percentages, I don't know, but it's probably like 0.00 something. There's over 42,000 people that have been sent back, and I think that we, you know, could probably count less than 50 people that have been taken out of MPP based on non-refoulement, and that's across the entire Southwest border.
This is Ashley. I think in Laredo as well, the structure seems to be set up so that they want to conduct the non-refoulement interviews on the same day as the court hearing on the same property and then allegedly issue non-refoulement decisions that same day as well, which, you know, means just by virtue of logistics that everything is going to be incredibly short and, you know, limited in terms of the amount of time that could be spent on the interview and the amount of time that could be spent on analyzing the claim. If somebody has to come in for court in the morning and then get through an interview and a decision in the same day after having gotten up probably at, you know, 2 or 3 or possibly earlier in the morning in order to get to court in the first place. So it's set up to not allow individuals to actually get through this process. And that's, you know, been corroborated by other reports from asylum officers who have said that they, you know, attempted to grant a non-refoulement request and it was overturned by a supervisor.
I will take our next question from Michaela Ross of Bloomberg. Your line is open.
Thanks so much for holding the call today. I just wanted to be clear if there could be any more detail shared about what in a regular immigration court, what kind of access for, know your rights presentations for legal observers or watchdogs, you know, what that would look like in comparison to what we're seeing open down, you know, in Brownsville and Laredo. And I also wanted to know if anything was known at this time about how physically they're going to be able to hear hundreds of cases a day from judges around the country, you know, how any idea from those judges, you know, how many are being pulled off? Do we know anything else about, you know, how they're going to have to pull off their normal caseload to do this?
Sure, I'd love for other folks to jump in, but we do know that IJs in other locations are being pulled from their regular dockets to do MPP hearings telephonically. So that will grow the backlog, the court backlog in other locations. If other folks want to jump in, I'm
Denise Gilman here in San Antonio. We were at the immigration court the other day, and several of the judges on the non-detained docket expressed very serious concern about the fact that they were going to have to completely reschedule all of their existing caseloads for the fall, starting in a couple of weeks. And many of those cases were asylum seeker cases where individuals had been waiting for 3+ years for a hearing date that had finally gotten set for this fall and now would be reset probably several years in addition into the future because the cases were already being set out a year or two into the future if they were set for a merits hearing today before MPP started. So there was some real frustration about that. In terms of access to the courts, typically for the non-detained court, those hearings are mostly open. A final merits asylum hearing typically would not be unless there was consent of the parties, in which case it would be open. Consent to the asylum seeker, essentially to ensure confidentiality, except where the individual is willing to have somebody in. And there have been, at least at the San Antonio Immigration Court, sort of information desks or otherwise kind of know your rights setups where local nonprofit attorneys are available and judges are able to refer people over to speak to the nonprofit attorneys to do intakes, to provide 589 forms, to explain what a hearing notice is for the next hearing. That's happening pretty regularly at the San Antonio court and will be completely unavailable in these tent courts. Access to the courts within detention centers has always been a bit more restricted and problematic. And so this new procedure is really just a on steroids version of previous problems with access. And I'll note that you know, really the place where these courts are is within sort of the Border Patrol, like the port of entry physical space, and it didn't have to be that way. Ashley made a reference to this. In fact, the city of Laredo had offered municipal land, which would have created a space that would have been much more accessible. So it's not by accident that the government is now asserting that there are security concerns because of the specific nature of the location. That location was selected by the government exactly for this purpose.
This is Ashley. I would just add that I understand on a press call yesterday with DHS that there was some comment about, you know, attorneys aren't, you know, can't be allowed to just run around soliciting clients everywhere, as that was some sort of excuse for not allowing more access to these courts. And I think it's both incredibly absurd and insulting to suggest that there are no private attorneys running around trying to find paying clients in Nuevo Laredo. You know, folks are just trying to ensure that individuals who are subject to this process have access to know your rights information and understand their rights and responsibilities in the process and have true access to counsel. And so, you know, this is such the opposite of any access to counsel that should be provided under our laws. And, you know, by setting these up in these, you know, quote unquote CBP properties, they have been able to turn over all of the access policies to DHS. And so yesterday in Laredo, there was a lot of confusion by ICE as to who even made the final decision about who gets to go in. And initially they were asking whether the decision about whether I could go into court was up to the judge. And then there was a question of whether OCC got to decide. And ultimately, ICE was able to make the decision because this is ICE's or DHS's property. And so that's who's calling the shots right now.
And Denise, again, I just want to add one last thing there. This gets a little bit into nitty-gritty, but it's highly relevant for actually being able to present an asylum claim. There's no clarity about how documents are even going to be filed because people are living in Mexico or surviving barely in Mexico. They're coming into this CBP territory where, as Ashley mentioned, there is no personnel from the immigration court there. And then their judge is in a remote location for now in San Antonio or relatively nearby, but eventually, as you say, probably around the country. So how is a 589 going to be filed? Apparently there's a fax machine there that they say will be used for that purpose. That might work for one or two applications. They're about 15 pages long. But when you get into hundreds of cases in a day, in a morning, how are those 589s, those asylum applications, going to get submitted to the judge? Are people going to be forced to try to mail them from Mexico? And then what happens when we get to the point where evidence is offered? Because there is a requirement under the law that pretty extensive evidence be offered in these cases, which often amounts to hundreds of pages. How is that going to get to the court in a timely manner, if at all?
will take our next question from Debbie Nathan of Intercept. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you so much for doing this. I've been following MPP in El Paso, so I'm interested in how things are working out differently with the tents over where you all are. I heard from a community reporter that only 2 out of the 6 people on the docket came. Is that correct, Jody? I heard you were there.
Yeah, that's correct, Debbie. There were 6 people on the docket. It was 2 Salvadorans, 1 Nicaraguan, and 3 Guatemalans. The only individuals that appeared for court this morning were the 2 Salvadorans.
What are the deportation in absentia issues? I mean, my understanding is that people are literally without addresses in Matamoros and in Laredo, Nuevo Laredo. So how does that work?
Well, that's an interesting point. In fact, that was one of the most disturbing portions of the court hearing that I watched this morning was the methods that were used in order to prove up the removability for the 4 individuals that did not appear. And despite the fact that there are numerous defects on the notice to appear, there was no inquiry, you know, on the part of the judge with respect to the issues with the addresses. What we've seen in Matamoros is that most individuals, when they are issued their notice to appear, they include as their address in Mexico one of 2 addresses. The first address that we've seen is domicilio conocido, which is known address, which is not a street, not a house number or anything of the sort. It's kind of like the old, if it was a small town and you were just a person that was known around town, you would, you know, your mail might arrive at the post office in town. Domicilio conocido is not an effective method of being able to give somebody notice of their hearing. The other address that we've seen is the address of one of the shelters in Matamoros. The individuals that we've seen through the legal orientation and the workshops that we've had in Matamoros have all indicated that they've never been to that shelter. It happens to be one of the shelters that's fairly small, that does not have a very large capacity, and the shelters are always full, and that's the reason why most people can't ever go to that shelter. So it's apparent that CBP, in processing their notices to appear, is inventing the address or just using that address, you know, as some form of placeholder so that they have that blank filled. But like I said, in the hearings this morning for in absentia orders, the judge didn't address the issue of the address at all, nor did she address any of the other issues surrounding the defects that are in every single NTA that I've seen.
So one question in the final follow-up. So were the 4 people who did not come, were they deported in absentia?
Yes, all 4 individuals that weren't present were deported in absentia.
Thank you, Julie.
And Denise, just chiming in again, also, it is really important to keep in mind that many people have either, because of the danger in Nuevo Laredo and Matamoros, moved to Mexico, or have been coercively placed on buses by Mexican authorities working with U.S. authorities and taken to other places in the country without any provision or guarantee that they will be assisted in returning to the border for their hearings. People have been taken to Monterrey by the busload, and actually quite a few busloads went without real agreement or understanding all the way down to Chiapas. And that situation is aggravated by the fact that while the U.S. government has asserted in the federal courts that asylum seekers have a pretty protected humanitarian status in Mexico, that is not, in fact, the paperwork that they are getting. So individuals are actually subject to detention and deportation in Mexico, particularly if they go further into the interior. And so some back to their hearings because they've had to go elsewhere in the country and just can't get physically back to the court. Others may well be detained or deported by Mexican authorities, which is a significant problem because it means that the U.S. is effectively actually deporting people back to their home countries through returning them to Mexico where the Mexican authorities do so.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. And we'll take our next question from Nicole Acevedo of NBC. Your line is open.
Thank you. So it seems like, you know, even though there's data that we've seen in past years that shows that people going through these proceedings do normally show up to court, but what we're seeing here, it's like essentially creating a bunch of hurdles that deprive these asylum seekers to actually be able to show up in court. Aside from possible deportation, are there other side effects that this may be causing by just making it more difficult for people to get counsel and maybe make it more difficult for them to show up at court?
This is Ashley. I mean, ultimately, this is preventing people from getting critical protection they need to prevent them from being persecuted or killed in their home countries. I mean, ultimately, people are having to make the decision as to whether it's more risky to try to remain in Mexico or try to make the trip to the bridge for court versus returning home and living and hiding. So I think at this point, for a lot of people, deportation is a serious consequence, but the bigger consequence is the ultimate consequence, which is can they get protection or are they going to be forced to return to a country where they're going to be killed?
This is Jody. I think another thing to add, too, is that for individuals, let's say, that are not able to make make the appearance for their court and they end up being ordered deported in absentia, there's a number of consequences that flow from that that are already built into the immigration statutes. So those same individuals, for example, would probably be barred from applying for any type of benefit under the Immigration Act for anywhere from 5 to 10 years. So there's, you know, aside from the more serious consequences of being returned to a place where they are subjected to persecution and danger, there's some, you know, very, very real statutory consequences as well from not appearing at their court.
And this is Ashley. I just had one more piece to that, that because of the arbitrariness in which the Remain in Mexico policy has been implemented, there are a number of people whose families have been separated as a result. So individuals where, you know, a husband and one child may have crossed a week or two before a wife and another child, and they got through and the other ones didn't, or a group of siblings who traveled and younger siblings who were deemed unaccompanied were let into the United States, and the older sibling, who maybe have only been 18 or 19 years old, was turned back. And in some of those cases, those family members will not be able to reunify, even if the individuals in the United States are able to get status, because if they have the in absentia order and they're facing these bars, they may be prevented from ultimately reuniting in the United States.
And I'll also just add an issue that I think Denise already touched on earlier in the call, but you know, there are many, many barriers to counsel built into MPP and built into these poor courts, but one of which that I think is, you know, maybe less obvious is just the ability to build trust between the client and the attorney and thus build, you know, the most accurate, zealous case for that client. There's not the time, not the space, not the money to effectively meet with your clients multiple times before these life or death hearings. So just want to flag that again.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. One moment while we queue. And it appears that we have no further questions at this time.
Well, I just want to thank the speakers again today for all your work and all your insights. Are there any last points that you wanted to make before we close out the call?
I don't think so. Thanks for all of the interest. And I would certainly, Denise, again, I would certainly encourage members of the press to visit the tent courts themselves and the proceedings from the court base in San Antonio and elsewhere. It's really critically important that there be as much public eye as possible on these proceedings.
Awesome. Totally agree with that. And I think, you know, we'll continue to push for public information being made by the agencies. Again, we have not had any or much to begin with, so we'll continue to look for answers. Thanks, everyone, so much for joining us today, and I think we can conclude our call there.